It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report lays out the extent of clergy sex abuse in Wisconsin over the years. We'll hear about the short and long-term effects for victims and the response from Catholic church leaders around the state. First, there are plenty of book clubs and people talking about books, but how many people are actually talking about their relationships with books? How did a book make them feel? How did a book change their lives? That's one of the main questions driving the new micro podcast from WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Here's the setup.
We interview a lot of writers on this show, but do you know that before we let them leave the studio, we usually ask them to tell us their favorite book?
My name is Margaret Atwood.
Tommy Orange.
Martin Amis.
I'm Gwenna Herzog.
This is Anne Lamott. A book that changed my life forever was Pippi Longstockings.
I was eating a donut, and I just realized what a novel could do for the first time.
Welcome to Bookmarks, a new weekly micro-podcast. Learn more at ttbook.org/bookmarks.
Anne Strange Champs is the host of To the Best of Our Knowledge. Anne, welcome back to Central Time.
So great to be here again, Rob. Hi.
And Shannon Henry Kleiber is a producer, interviewer, and writer for To the Best of Our Knowledge. Shannon, thanks for joining us in the studio, too.
Hi, Rob.
Anne, what's the story behind these stories?
Okay, well, to the best of our knowledge, as I just said, interviews a lot of writers. And for years, we've been asking them to, before they leave the studio, to tell us about a favorite book, a book that kind of left a mark on them. And we haven't really done anything with this audio. And I don't know, last year sometime, maybe we were cleaning out some files or something and realized we have, Shannon, how many? 60? At least. At least of
these. And incredible authors on books that are surprising sometimes. And we thought we should do something with it.
Yeah, we really felt like we were, you know, hoarding these things. And, and you know, it's fun producing an hour-long program, but we decided we wanted these to be little tiny, tiny jewels. So it's kind of an experiment. Micro podcasts are a new thing. We thought, we'll try it.
And it's easy to say, oh, here's a book that I liked. Here's a book that I enjoyed. Did everybody have an answer for this question about a life-changing book?
No way. And we had to learn how to ask the question
correctly,
too. Don't you think the early ones were more like book reports?
Book reports. So, yeah, you don't want to just hear, here's the plot, here's what I liked. You want to hear, you know, that they hated the book and then they learned to love it, or they met their spouse through it, or they had this incredible revelation through it somehow.
And not everybody has a dramatic story, but when we changed what we were asking and stopped saying, can you tell us about a favorite book, and started saying, is there a book that's really left a mark on you? A book that, you know, you love it or you hate it, but you can't forget it. That's when we started getting, little stories.
Well, I want to give a listen to one of those to get a taste of this. Anne Lamott, novelist and nonfiction writer, talking about what one young female character allowed her to feel.
This is Anne Lamott, and a book that changed my life forever was Pippi Longstockings. I was an early reader and found literal salvation in chapter books. The first one I remember was Pippi Longstockings, about this little Swedish girl with braids that stuck straight out, one black sock and one brown sock, and a horse that lived with her, and a monkey whose name I think was Mr. Nilsson. And her father was the king of a cannibal island. He had floated off somewhere. I don't remember if we know what happened to her mother, but she lived alone next to slightly priggish Swedish girls whose names I think are Tommy and Annika. And she radicalizes them. She gets them to do things that are way scarier than I would ever do. She teaches them to go a little farther beyond their garden than they've ever gone before. She makes them laugh. Sometimes she just picks up her horse and carries them out to the front porch for a little fresh air. And when I read that book, I thought, there's a place in this world for me, for odd, strange, strong me.
Great.
And I thank the author every few days.
A great story there. I've learned that Pippi Longstockings was Swedish. I read the books as a kid and they were in English when I read them, and I never put it together. Do you see themes, Shannon, emerge from stories like Anne's and the other 50 stories you heard from authors and creators?
Definitely. So childhood is a big theme. Definitely the kind of those early books can have such an effect on us, whether it's one of the first books we read or something that, you know, we learned about a certain part of the world for the first time. There's also themes, I think, in kind of other stages of life, like, you know, in your young 20s and starting out in a certain job or in a relationship. And you remember that time in your life. So there's kind of the geography of some of them.
Talking to Anne Strainchaps and Shannon Henry Kleiber from To the Best of Our Knowledge, talking about their micro podcast called Bookmarks, about how authors and makers have had their lives changed by another book or an author. And did going through these change the way you think about books? And you've thought about books a lot over the years.
I have. You know, partly because at some point I thought, you know, this is harder than I thought, because I challenged myself, could I come up with a bookmark? Part of me was probably thinking, what is the matter with these people? Why can't they give us better bookmarks? Why is it so hard to come up with a good story about encountering a book? So I tried using some of the little prompts that we give writers myself, and it was really wonderful. I wound up remembering books that I haven't thought of for a long time, or books that I read and reread. It made me really think about why and what it is that book is giving me. And yeah, I realized I had taken books seriously, but not necessarily my own life as a reader seriously.
That's interesting. Those are two different things.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. I was used to the books being the stars, and maybe I could have an opinion about a book, but I didn't really think of of how much reading books shapes my life. Each interaction with a book is like meeting another person. And every time you meet somebody, you know, you meet lots of people. Many of them may wind up meaning not that much to you, but you meet a few special people over the course of your life who really change how you think of yourself and the world and the course of your life.
And Shannon, let's make it even more complicated. You have a piece in the Best of Our Knowledge episode that sets this up about a book club that you're in. So now it's not just you and a book and how you relate to it, but you and your book club compatriots and how you relate to each other and the book.
Yeah, you know, collective reading is really profound, I think, and powerful. So my book club has been together. We're going into our 10th year.
Wow.
So we've read close to 100 books together.
Wow.
And that is a real relationship. So there's 12 of us, 12 women, and we really do read the book, and we talk about the book, but we talk about life and everything else and our kids and our, you know, everything going on. But there's something about, you know, you might read a book that you would never have chosen before with a book club. You might have an idea that you wouldn't have had if it wasn't for the collective reading together.
That's something that you're forced to do, and I'm forced to do on the show too, Anne, is we'll often read books that might not have come across our personal selections, and it really forces you to branch out.
Well, and I feel you must too, that, I mean, I've grown so much as a person and feel lucky that I've been forced to read books for a living. And as you both said, books that I would not necessarily have chosen. I think in some ways, you know, it's kind of like Facebook or political tribalization. We all kind of want to read the stuff we're comfortable with.
If you like blank, then try blank.
Yeah. And when you're forced out of that and forced to, you know, the first time I had to read a book about quantum physics, and I thought, I don't understand this, but I had to. It changed my life. So, you know, these are good things.
We're talking to Anne Strainchamps and Shannon Henry Kleiber from WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge, talking about their show's new podcast called Bookmarks. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a book that changed your life in some way, whatever that means to you? Something that you can divide your life a little bit into pre that book and post that book, or could be an author in all of their works. And what is it about that book that kept you coming back and maybe thinking about it differently over the years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with, to the best of our knowledge, host Anne Strainchamps and producer Shannon Henry Kleiber. We're talking about their new micro podcast. It's called Bookmarks, featuring authors and creators who share the story of books that changed their lives in one way or another. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a book from your childhood or adult life that you look back on and say, yeah, that did change the way I think about things, or that you've had a ongoing relationship over the years, where maybe it meant one thing as a teenager, something different now as a grown-up. Call in at 800-642-1234. Are you in the middle of that book right now? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Well, I want to ask you too, if going through this, you came up with your own bookmarks. Shannon, let's start with you.
So one of the most influential books in my life was Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And I just loved the fantasy world of dropping into another whole universe and all the possibilities that could happen when you think it is impossible. So I really loved that. But I came to it because my parents had this, they would order the 100 greatest books of all time, and they would come really gradually in these beautiful leather-bound volumes with gold leaf. And that was the first one of all of them that I could read when I was old enough to read. And then gradually I read many of the rest of them in that 100 greatest books.
And Anne?
Well, mine is going to dovetail so perfectly. I didn't
oh, you didn't prepare this?
No,
okay.
I did not know about Alice in Wonderland. We have to talk. so mine is the All Souls trilogy by Deborah Harkness, and in particular the first book, Discovery of Witches. So this is my comfort read for a particular kind of malaise, the loss of enchantment, which I think that we all suffer from to a greater or lesser degree. If for nothing else, then I think a lot of us miss that feeling of being children and reading Alice in Wonderland or Harry Potter and feeling that magic just might be real. This book is about a young historian. Her name is Diana Bishop. She is descended from a long line of witches, but Diana wants nothing to do with magic and has cultivated a carefully ordinary life. She is a historian who studies alchemy and Elizabethan science, and in real life, that's what the author, Deborah Harkness, does. And the story begins when Diana accidentally opens an alchemical manuscript in Oxford's Bodleian Library, and she discovers that it's bewitched, and that it's a book that the creatures, the magical creatures in the world, vampires, witches, and demons, have been seeking for centuries. And this book seems to have been spelled to open only for her. So really, this is the story of a woman who has tried to be good, to restrain, to cover up her natural, born, inherent magical powers. And it's the story of how she rediscovers magic and reclaims her own powers and discovers their uniqueness. So, you know, how can this not be my comfort read when,
love
I,
it.
Need,
oh, it sounds
when I need more magic and a sense of empowerment?
Well, I've detected a theme in both of yours, the enchantment in both of your selections. That's great. Well, let's see what our callers have on their list. We'll go first to Lenny in McFarland. Lenny, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Lenny?
When I was little, I'm now 90, I had access to my grandfather's library, and in it was a lot of history. And I read A Child's History of England. And I was so distressed by the injustice and the violence that I decided there was not a benevolent God, at best an indifferent one, who did not put down his furry hand to correct injustice. And I really cried.
Wow.
Wow.
That's Charles Dickens's, I think, Child History of England. So age 9, and still you could hear she's feeling it, Anne, at age 90.
Yeah.
The emotion. Yeah, that's one thing that is really incredible. When the book causes an emotion, whether it's surprise or happiness or sadness, it's memorable.
Thank
and
you.
I think often books like that, it's the combination of the emotion and the idea that's brought together. When those things come together powerfully in a book, wow.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Lenny. We'll go now to Sheila with us in Waukesha. Sheila, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What book did you want to share with us, Sheila?
Well, actually, also at 9, I had my first, I guess, big revelation, and that was when I was going through Hodgkin's disease and cancer treatments. My mother read The Hobbit to me and Lord of the Rings, and when I went through my chemo treatments then and had to lay there and just kind of think about things, I decided that each one of the chemo drugs was going to be a different fellowship member, and they were fighting the orcs which were the cancer cells. So, you know, it was something that kind of helped me get through that. And then I also wanted to mention that later in my teens, when I discovered Tom Robbins and that kind of whole genre of books, one of the passages that I always remember to this day is when he's talking about seeing people walking around in the rain, and instead of being all hunched over and hiding from it, they were turning their faces up to the sky and treating it like a blessing. And I think I've always, since that moment, tried to kind of do that with myself and just remember, you know, that weather is there for a reason, and sometimes it is a blessing. So.
And Sheila, I got to ask before we let you go, do you go back to The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and, you know, given that special place it has for you?
Oh, my God, yes. Of course, I've got pretty much every Tolkien book I can get, including, you know, an Atlas of Middle Earth. And, you know, that it also opened up a lot of, you know, kind of philosophical questions in my young mind. And then over the years, I returned to it again and again, and love the movies as well, too. So,
Sheila, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Wow. Can I just add my... So, I loved also The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings as a kid. I actually taught myself Elvish, and then I introduced those books to my kids, and my daughter taught herself Elvish, but she's smarter than I am, so she learned it a lot better. And for a long time, she kept a journal in Elvish so that nobody in the family could read it. And our family still, every year at Christmas time, watches all 9 hours of the Lord of the Rings movies.
Those repeat encounters are so incredible. If you have it as your as a young child, and then you keep on remembering when you read it and what was happening in your life and what you find different as you read it in at different ages and different stages of your life.
I do find it so remarkable how many people, the first thing they think of is a book they read when they were 9, 10, 13. That's come up over and over with the writers that we talked with for bookmarks.
Sheila, thanks so much for the call. We're talking to Anne Strainchamps and Shannon Henry Kleiber, both with, to the best of our knowledge, talking about their new podcast called Bookmarks. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Laval. Mike, hello.
Hi. Really a pleasure to talk to all of you. To the best of our knowledge, and Central Time are two of my favorite shows.
So thanks,
a real
Mike.
Treat. A couple of things. I've read a couple of authors, like everything that they've written, just by getting hooked on one book. And the first one, back in high school, I wasn't really a reader, but I had to pick a book for a book report. And I had just seen the movie East of Eden on TV. And so I read the book by Steinbeck. And I was so taken by the writing and the storytelling and how much it drew me into the experience. But I ended up reading everything that Steinbeck wrote, you know, ending up with his very early novels. But I remember reading The Grapes of Wrath and being really challenged, because back then, when I was like 16, I was really politically conservative. And so I'm reading The Grapes of Wrath thinking, Steinbeck a subversive person of some kind, you know? but it really helped change my worldview in a healthy way. And then later, when I was like in my late 20s, somebody suggested the Ginger Man by J.B. Donlevy, and again I was like so taken into the book that I read everything that Donlevy wrote, and the Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar B. is still one of my favorite novels.
Mike, thank you so much for sharing all that. There's a lot there we could run with, but John Steinbeck turned a non-reader into a reader. That's pretty profound right there.
Yeah, it makes me think about that bookmark. We have Tommy Orange, who just won the National Book Award, I think, for his novel There, There. Talked about the book he read. He wasn't a reader and stumbled on a book in his 20s.
The Confederacy of Dunces.
Right, yeah. Confederacy of Dunces. And it's the first book that made him, A, want to read, and B, think that maybe he could be a writer.
Wow. Anything else stand out to you that you want to tease from the podcast series, Shannon?
Oh, we have so many cool things coming up. So it is surprising when you hear different people like Tommy Orange, you know, what is he going to really choose? So I'll give you a couple names. I'll give you Margaret Atwood on Why It's Eric SOC, Alice Walker on Disturbing the Peace, Martin Amis on The Adventures of Augie March, and Lydia Yuknovich on Born. And I edited that last one, Lydia Yuknovich on Born. And her love of this book was so profound that she read it, fell asleep, woke up in the middle of the night, and started to read it again.
Wow.
And you know what? I guess what I would say is the main thing that this whole project has revealed to me is the power of, I like to think of them as our secret lives as readers, because we all have this interior life when we're reading to ourselves. Sometimes it's late at night. Sometimes we just sink into that special space where it's just a book and us. That's a whole secret life that we often don't share with each other. But at the very least, you know, how wonderful to validate it more and maybe begin to talk about it more.
Well, I've got to think this would be fun for writers to listen to as well, because they've put all their work in and then they release their creation out into the world. But it's not just what mm-hmm. ends up on the page or the screen, I guess. If it's an ebook, it's the end result is when the person reads it, who they are when they read it. It's got to be informative about the act of creation, too.
And the magic, part of the magic for me is, none of these books that people are recommending are new books. You know, they're not the latest ones the publishers are pushing. These are books that have been around sometimes for centuries, and some new reader comes along and pulls it off a library shelf and is entranced. You know, books are immortal in a way that we're not. And that's very beautiful to me and magical.
It's a micro podcast, meaning each episode is pretty short, but there's lots of them, right?
Right.
That's
not
very micro.
One is just 3 to 5 minutes, which is just kind of so beautiful and sound designed in a beautiful way. And you can listen to a lot of them at once, or you can listen to one, which is kind of cool.
They're like a little box of chocolates.
Yeah.
And the first season is 13 episodes, and then we'll take a month break, and then we'll release another 13 in season 2.
And then you keep interviewing people for To the Best of Our Knowledge.
We do. We're still collecting bookmarks.
We're always gathering. Yes.
So this micro podcast could go on infinitely.
Yeah, right. Forever.
Thank you both so much for sharing it with us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
We've been talking to Anne Strainchamps and Shannon Henry Kleiber from WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. We talked to them today about their new micro podcast, which could go on a long time in little bits and pieces. It's called Bookmarks. You can listen at ttbook.org/bookmarks or wherever you find your podcasts. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at a new report that details clergy sex abuse in Wisconsin and how various dioceses around the state are responding to it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, astronomers have discovered hundreds of planets in the last decade, and it turns out things are pretty weird out there by Earthling standards. We'll talk to a science writer about some of the latest discoveries. First, according to a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, at least 170 Catholic priests and brothers in the state have been credibly accused of sexual abuse. That number is likely to grow. Only 3 of Wisconsin's dioceses have released names of abusive priests. The other 2 have not. Plus, many religious orders have not shared information on the issue. The center talked with abuse victims about what happened to them and how the abuse affected their lives. It also reported on actions the church says it has taken to prevent abuse and provide transparency. Bram Sable-Smith is the WPR Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bram, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about those numbers. First of all, what can you tell us about where we arrive at this number of about 170 priests and brothers?
That's right. As you mentioned, there are 5 dioceses in the state of Wisconsin, in Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, La Crosse, and Superior. 3 of those dioceses conducted their own investigations and publicly released the names of priests who had credible allegations of sexual abuse within the diocese. So there were 48 names in Milwaukee, 48 also in Green Bay. Here in Madison, there were 8. But then, as you mentioned, La Crosse and Superior, neither one of those dioceses have publicly released lists of information. So we looked at other sources of information, public records, case records, as well as reporting that's been done around the state over the past many years to try to come up with an accurate number in those dioceses as well.
And that the idea that some dioceses have released information like this, others haven't, it points toward what comes out in this story you worked on, a patchwork of responses. They're all part of the same overarching Catholic organization, but they're approaching issues like transparency and investigations differently.
That's exactly right. Between the five dioceses, we know that every single one of them has taken their own investigation of what occurred within their diocese, but the way they're handling it is very different, and the way they're releasing it to the public is very different. And that doesn't include the few dozen, I think 22 religious orders in the state of Wisconsin who are separate from the diocese, and they also handle this in different ways at all. We only really got really good numbers from one of those orders.
As we mentioned, some are releasing these names, some aren't. The Madison Diocese has published names on its website. I want to give a listen to Bishop Donald Hying and what he had to say about it.
I think it does several things that are helpful. It certainly gives credibility to victims of those individuals. Oftentimes when they would make their allegations, they would not be believed, even sometimes by their own families. So this gives credibility to those who have been so severely damaged by those individual priests. And secondly, I think it opens the door for others who perhaps have been abused by those individuals to also come forward and find healing.
The Catholic Church has been under a lot of criticism in Wisconsin, around the country, around the world for not taking steps like these to do those two things that we just heard the bishop talking about there. As you look at that diocese and others and other organizations, are they talking about, what can they do to help the victims and find healing?
I think it's happening in varying degrees between the different dioceses. I think that's one of the issues of the patchwork that you mentioned before. What the bishop was talking about there, the two points he made, I just want to emphasize that those seem really kind of, it's a drastically different approach than what a lot of what we've seen in the past from the way that dioceses have responded to these allegations. So the first point he made, naming the priests to give credence to the people who have come forward with accusations of abuse that happened to them when they were children within the diocese. That's a hugely important step. So opening that door is really and giving that credibility to survivors is a really, really important step. You could almost call it radical, the emphasis on that. And then opening that door to have more people come forward, it just shows kind of a something of a change in how the church has responded, particularly at the Madison Diocese here. And Bishop Hying is—he's new. He just became bishop there this year, so it's a very directional shift for how the diocese seems to be responding.
For the organizations that haven't done things like reveal the name of priests who have had these credible allegations of abuse, like the Superior Diocese and La Crosse Diocese, what are they saying about why they're not doing what their colleagues have done?
It's hard to say. In some cases, we just haven't really gotten responses. In the case of the Superior Diocese, we haven't, our requests for information just have gone unresponded to. At La Crosse, in the La Crosse Diocese, it seems like they are wrapping up their own investigation. So we are expecting to see a list coming out of that diocese later in the year is what they've said. So that one seems to be something of a timeline.
Talking to Bram Sable-Smith with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about a report from the center on priest abuse here in Wisconsin and how different organizations have responded to it and how it's affected the lives of victims. And that's where I want to turn now. You profile some victims of clergy abuse who have come forward, including a woman named Patty Gallagher Marchant. Can you tell us her story?
Yeah, Patty Gallagher Marchant grew up going to a parochial school here in Monona, Wisconsin. And in 1965, when she was seven in second grade, there's a young, charismatic priest named Lawrence Trainer who befriended her family. He would come over for dinners. He would go out drinking with her father, and he sexually abused her. She violated her in every way imaginable, is what she says. And so the way it occurred was simply he would have a elected special child at the school for a given week or a month or some period of time who would come and bring him his daily milk before school in his office. And that's where it would occur. And that's what happened with her.
And now years, decades later, Gallagher Marchant is a psychotherapist. Here's what she says still badly frustrates her.
anywhere else in our culture, if a teacher, a janitor, a neighbor, an uncle, a brother, a grandma, anybody violates a child, the community is outraged. In my case, nobody showed any outrage. There was no outrage. That's what's painful. Where's the outrage? Even from the Catholic community, that's what makes me really mad to this day. Like, where is the outrage?
And she had come forward before this was a widely known, or at least widely openly acknowledged scandal, I should say.
That's exactly right. She said she's been told she was the first person to publicly come forward to report this in the state of Wisconsin. We haven't verified that, but she was definitely among the first very early on. 1991 is when she came forward. And Patty Gallagher-Marchant's story is very indicative of a lot of survivors of pre-sexual abuse. It occurred when she was very young. She repressed those memories for many, many, many years. The average age that people actually remember, that people report the sexual abuse they occurred when they were children, is 52. She, in her case, when she was 35 in 1991, her own daughter turned 7, which is the age that she was when she suffered from the abuse. And that brought the flooding of memories back to her. She reported it to the diocese because she wanted to let them know that there's this priest who's still active within the diocese who's out there still. To her, it became very apparent that she was perceived as a threat in those conversations for the diocese. And they went into a kind of arduous legal process that ended in a settlement for her in 1992, I believe. But it actually gagged her from being able to speak out, speak the name publicly of the priest who committed the abuse against her for many years.
I can't remember if it was her, one of the victims you talked to, talked about feeling like she was treated as a leper. Basically, everybody turned away from her. And I think it was Gallagher-Marchant who said, reported, they sort of mocked her, like, what do you want us to do, set up a hotline for priest abuse survivors, which I think may exist now, though they joked about it then.
They joked about it then, and that actually was one of the five things that she had demanded when she came in 1991, when she got into into this legal process with the church. She had asked for an apology, a public apology. She had asked for a meeting with the priest who abused her, a confrontational meeting. She had asked for a meeting with the bishop to talk about moving things forward. She had asked for resources to be there for people like her who had suffered this abuse. And then she asked for the monetary settlement. It took a long time for these resources to come into play. So there are, every diocese now in Wisconsin does have a number you can call, people who are the dedicated people to field request information, things like that.
And one ongoing issue, Bram, is how the church and how various elements of the church are training staff, whether that's priests or support personnel or administrators or whatever, in ways to try to prevent abuse. What kind of approaches are we seeing?
Yeah, advocates like SNAP, the SNAP network, that's a survivors network of those abused by priests. They're very outspoken on a national level about this issue. It's the same issues they have with the training that's being done are the issues that they have with how the investigations themselves are being done. And that's that, one, it's a patchwork. There's no kind of common training being done between the churches. There are resources available through insurance agencies and others for training and creating safe environment spaces. But there's no outside. I guess their criticism, activist criticism, is that this is training that's done by the church for the church, and activists would rather see outsiders coming in, the secular community coming in and training church officials.
Bram, thanks for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thanks very much.
Bram Sable-Smith is the WPR Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We talked with him about the center's new report on clergy abuse here in Wisconsin. You can read the full story and find contact info to report clergy abuse. That's all linked at WPR.org. Coming up, new technology is helping astronomers learn more about planets in distant solar systems. What they're finding has them rethinking the way planets are made. We'll find out more in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report from the Associated Press shows a growing political fight over the way prisoners are counted in the U.S. Census, including a Wisconsin bill that would end what critics call prison gerrymandering. We'll hear more from the reporter on that story. First, new technology is helping astronomers discover lots and lots of planets in distant solar systems and learn more about them. Some of those planets have shown up in places and styles that scientists didn't expect, making them rethink old theories of how planets form. and new telescopes keep coming online, providing new answers and opening up new questions. Daniel Cleary is Science Magazine's senior correspondent in the United Kingdom and author of the book A Piece of the Sun, The Quest for Fusion Energy. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's nice to be with you.
Well, there was this boom in the number of exoplanets being discovered over the last decade or so. And it sounds like in addition to all this quantity, we're starting to see more quality. What kind of new things are we able to learn about planets in other solar systems?
At the moment, you can't find out very much about individual planets. You can find out how close they are to their star, how large they are. But that's about it, you know. So it's mostly been a matter of getting a lot of statistics, finding as many planets as we can, what sort of stars are they orbiting, how large they are, and how close to their stars. And that's told us amazing things, because what they found are planetary systems that are completely unlike our own, which was a big surprise for astronomers.
Let's get into that, because I think, understandably, a lot of our guesses about how solar systems worked were based on the one we stand in all the time. It turns out things are really different in a lot of solar systems. What kind of weirdnesses, by our standards, have we discovered out there?
Well, you know, right from the very first planet around another star, or exoplanet, that was discovered in 1995, it was completely unexpected. It was a big planet, you know, sort of 150 times the mass of Earth, so about half the size of Jupiter. But it was really, really close to its star. It was closer than Mercury, our closest planet to the sun. It was closer than that to its star. And astronomers just had no idea how you could form such a large planet so close in, because there's just not enough material there to make a large planet.
And if I remember this right, some of these large planets we astronomers have found close to suns, their year in some cases is 4 days. It takes us 4 days to go around their sun.
Yeah, that's true. That first one, 51 Pegasi b, it's called, takes 4 days to orbit. So as you can imagine, it's whipping around its star really fast.
Why did we think we couldn't have a planet that big, a gas giant, that close to its sun?
Well, it's a matter of what you make planets out of. You know, when a star forms, it's essentially just comes from a cloud of dust and gas that exists out in space that starts to pull itself together under its own gravity. And soon, the stuff that's in the middle forms a star, and when there's enough of it and it gets hot enough, it starts to burn. And then what's left over forms itself into a disk that orbits around the star. And it's from this disk that planets start to form. So, first you'll have dust grains that start to glom together, and then they'll form pebbles and eventually rocks. And you just build up like that in a hierarchical way. And once they get to the size of a small planet, they start, orbiting around their star, and they just hoover up everything else because of their own gravity. And if you're very close to the star, you're on a very short path, so there isn't much stuff to hoover up. But if you're way out, your path can take years to travel around the star, and so there's lots of material, and so you can form a big planet. But close in, there just isn't the stuff. So, people were really confused by that.
So it sounds like there's an argument between the idea that, okay, maybe we got it wrong. There's a way that a big Jupiter-type planet could form that close to the sun. Or, no, we were right, but it started way out there and for some reason decided to relocate in closer to the sun.
Yes, astronomers are still arguing about this. Some think that, if you have a disk that maybe just was a lot richer in material, you might be able to form a large planet close in. But others disagree, and they think the planet must have formed further out and then drifted in. So there could have been sort of drag in the disk that caused it to slow down and slowly drift in. Or sometimes if you have more than one planet and they pass a bit too close to one another, their gravity can cause an interaction and you can get a planet shifted into another orbit. And that could be making planets a swing in close to the star.
Talking to Daniel Cleary, Science Magazine's senior UK correspondent, looking at weird solar systems and weird planets, weird as defined by what we see by comparison in our own solar system. Daniel, let's check out another kind. We hear a lot about this, these super Earths. So they're, you know, they're kind of like Earth, but they're really big. What are we seeing out there?
Yeah, in fact, that seems to be the most common sort of planet we've found so far. There was a NASA satellite called Kepler, which essentially just stared at one spot in space for several years and tried to get as many, many planets as it could find. And it found several thousand. And the most common type was a bit bigger than Earth and a bit smaller than Neptune. So it's in this in-between zone that doesn't exist in our solar system. And again, astronomers couldn't explain that. You know, they weren't quite sure how you could make a planet of that size because, you know, they so far had based all their theories about planet formation on our solar system. And they'd come up with theories that explained our solar system very well. So, but as soon as they were faced with different things, their theories didn't work anymore.
Are we starting to see technology come online or maybe just around the corner that's going to give us more insight into not just the size and the orbit and things like that, but what planets are made of, what's going on inside?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about better telescopes. So astronomers are always building and wanting better telescopes. And there's lots of stuff coming online in the next few years. There's several projects to build truly enormous telescopes on Earth. One called the Extremely Large Telescope, and another called the 30-meter telescope. So at the moment, the biggest telescopes are about 10 meters across. But so the 30-meter telescope, as you can imagine, is three times that width. And the extremely large telescope is slightly larger than that, about 39 meters across. So these are colossal instruments that will gather a lot of light and enable you to, you know, separate out the planet from the star. That's the problem with looking for planets around other solar systems, is that stars are really bright and planets are very dim, and they're very close together because they're so far away. So it's very hard to separate out the light from the planet from the star. And in most cases, we can't see the planet itself, but we see the effect it has. So, you know, a lot of the exoplanets we've discovered so far, we found because they pass in front of their star and cause it to dip in brightness just a tiny little amount. And that's how we know we're there. And that's all we know about them, is from the shadow they cast when they pass in front of their star.
Ooh, before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you about another kind of planet. I hadn't heard about these. I heard of the super Earths and the hot Jupiters, the super puff. What's a super puff?
Yeah, well, that was another very mysterious sort of planet that people found, which didn't seem to be very heavy, but seemed to be very large. So they, you know, their only conclusion is that it must have just a very dense core, solid core in the middle, and then a very, very thick atmosphere, which is sort of being heated up because it's close to its star. And so it's all puffed out. And, you know, is just this sort of big ball of gas with a small little planetary core in the middle. So, again, something that is very foreign to us because nothing like that exists in our solar system.
In our last 40 seconds or so, Dan, I keep saying these other solar systems are weird. It seems like it's looking more and more like we're the weird ones here.
Yeah, it's starting to look like we're not typical, you know, that ours is a bit of an outlier. There's another really interesting one nearby that people are very excited about, which has got five or seven planets that are all Earth-sized. So they're like all really close together, close to their star. So if you lived on one of those planets, you'd be able to see these other Earth-like planets really nearby. And with a telescope, you might be able to make out, you know, people on other planets just, you know, as these other planets passed by. You know, it's a weird idea, but it's very, very different from what we know from our solar system.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing this.
It was a pleasure.
Daniel Cleary is Science Magazine's senior correspondent in the United Kingdom. He talked with us about the field of exoplanet research and how new discoveries are making astronomers rethink our ideas about how planets form, finding surprising planets all over the place. And as we heard, some new gear is going to go online in the next few years that could answer a lot more questions about these weird solar systems. It's holiday season. That means it's holiday movie season, too. And at least someone's going to get paid to watch these movies. An internet company is offering $1,000 plus hot cocoa and cookies to someone who's willing to watch 24 Hallmark holiday movies in 12 days and then do a good job of talking about it on social media. We've got a fan here, producer Rachel Vasquez. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Rob.
You like the Hallmark and Lifetime and all these holiday movies, I hear?
I love them. I love them so much.
And do you have a holiday season ritual of watching
24
in 12 days, say?
This is, no, not exactly, not yet. This is my third year of watching them during Christmas. It started pretty much right around October for me this year, so it's getting earlier and earlier. I want to say for the record that I used to hate watch them, and
okay.
It has evolved into loving them.
Yeah, what is it that turned you from being against to being for?
Good question. I feel like something about the formula of everything working out in the end is deeply comforting to me. Also, I'm an overworked, tired lady, and the movies are often about those kind of ladies, and so I really identify with them.
Now, do you share these movies with others, or is this a solitaire experience for you?
It's usually pretty solitary. Sometimes I share it with my fiance's mom, which has been a great bonding experience. Haven't been able to get my fiance to do it yet, though.
All right, get lots of hot cocoa and cookies for the season. Thanks, Rachel. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.